Confusion matrix.
Rolling. Welcome back, Pete. How are you today?
Very good. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm not too bad. I'm cold. I'm feeling really cold. I was lulled into a false sense of security by some sunshine, big glowing orb in the sky over the last couple of weeks, and it's now cold and I'm grumpy about it. But otherwise, I'm keeping well.
The big orb is coming out in force in the next week down this part of the world anyway.
Well, I do hope it comes out for us too. Okay, good. Let's pray for sun. We'll do a little sun dance. But in the meantime, let's talk about some stuff, data science-y stuff. What have you got for us today?
Well, unfortunately, we couldn't stay away from AI for too long.
I think we mostly managed it last week, right?
I think we did well, a whole episode. So I'm just going to, I stumbled upon something this week. It's just an article that I read by a guy called Tristan Handy, and he's writing in something called the Analytics Engineering Roundup. And he was talking about specifically how AI will disrupt BI as we know it. BI obviously being business intelligence. And so just to sort of summarize and paraphrase the bits that interested me from the article. So he talked about BI tools in 2025 fulfilling three main roles, sort of modeling the data being the first one, which he says some don't even do that much. Then doing EDA, which I love this expression because I always think, what's EDA? And it's all exploratory data analysis. Oh, right, what I do. Why don't I know the three-letter acronym for what I do? then second job's that. And then the third job is presentation. And he talks about, he goes on, talks about scaling criticality of analysis and skips over the first data bit, really, the modeling. So you've got data.
Hold on a second, right? So let's rewind a bit and state what we mean. And I'm guessing we mean the same thing as this guy, this handy guy, about what BI is. And I think what we're talking about here is tools such as Tableau, Power BI, what's the other one? I can't even remember. There's a bunch of them, right?
Yeah.
They are mainly aimed at wider distribution of interactive or in fact static data and data visualizations. And so every fairly large business will have one. You and me have both worked in or around BI. In fact, I ran at least one, if not two, BI teams in the past, many moons ago, working with Cognos and Business Objects they were still things, before Tableau took over. And then I believe Power BI pretty much took over from Tableau. And there's a whole bunch of players on the market. I've got lots of opinions about BI, lots. And most of them aren't particularly good, but I'll reserve them and let you continue.
Yeah, well, I think some of that's going to come into my thinking on it as well. But anyway, so yeah, getting back exactly that, as you say, visualization tools. And he points out some of the good things about them. You know, like I say, so you get the data in, which is what he calls the modeling side, and you can manipulate or not in the tool maybe. And then the tool allows you to do some, you know, exploratory analysis, which he again says, we'll come back to that as to how good they are, but it's there. And the reason you do it in a tool like that is because of the next step, getting it out to presentation and then to production, is easy. And he even talks about how we work of doing stuff in Python first, get hold of the data and then trying to get it out, and how that becomes a bit of a blocker. And so therefore that's why you might do your exploratory data analysis in the tool, you know. And I thought that was fair enough, because, you know, we avoid the tools partly because they hamstring you a little in your analysis because they're not as sophisticated on the analysis side. And of course, there are new types of analysis coming out, you know, from the data science community, and they just don't keep up with it. And if you get into some of the models that come out of the data science community, it's far more in depth. You know, and I think the emphasis really goes on to the analyst there, you know, and that's where we sit, right? And I understand that a company wants to be able to put in a tool, give it to 50 people and say, hey, look, we're doing it, rather than train 10 people properly what they should be doing. And hence why we come across people that have the tool and maybe do the easy bit, which is the visualization, number three, and maybe even the data modeling, because really what you're doing there is matching up, you know, data coming in and making it usable. But the bit in the middle, the analysis in order to get insights for business users, is far more nuanced. And I think we've come across this several times where you go into a business, they have that, and it's out with, you know, some business users, but business leaders are fairly unhappy with the results. And, you know, and I get why they would be. They bought a tool, they've been sold the dream that now everyone can give them insights and they'll be a data-led business. And 2 years later, they've got a lot more dashboards, but they're still struggling with insight. And I'm sure that's where some of your thinking is as well.
Yeah, I find business intelligence so tedious. And this cycle of promise and disappointment has been a perennial problem. And it really stems from the fact that data is complicated, right? And that what any sort of front-end business-facing tool seeks to do and necessarily has to do is to tame that. And really, you know, the stuff like Tableau and Power BI exist as sort of extensions on the Excel paradigm. And I would still prefer to use Excel than any of those tools. But then, you know, Excel's a terrible distribution tool. It's a nightmare because you're sending around files, even on 365 or, you know, Google Sheets. It's still highly volatile and not a very robust distribution method of data, whereas these BI tools tend to lock the data down a bit, provide better visualization tools and a certain amount of drill down and slice and dice, which is hard to orchestrate with Excel. But the problem you've got here is that the majority of things put out on Power BI are going to be just largely static dashboards. Of you know, sales or whatever it is, your top line KPIs, and with a certain amount of you know, refinement, like date range or only for this particular division or whatever, and these things tend to bloody breed. They proliferate because every single dashboard is not quite right for someone. And okay, so I've got the master dashboard, but I want the you know, the manufacturing view or the shoe sales view, and you go down, but no, that's not the right KPIs for me. I need my own specific shoe division dashboard. And so the dashboards, that one gets cloned off, adapted, and they start to breed like spreadsheets seem to do. And suddenly you've got, you know, death by spreadsheet, and then you've got death by BI. You've replaced death by spreadsheet with death by BI. And people don't tend to notice or want to use these drill down or refinement features. And because they're not analysts, they don't really think like that. They just want the data that they want, and they don't want to have to think about it. And so we get this situation where all the main platforms are plumbed in, like R or Python or something into their platforms that allow for much more sophisticated things to be done. They allow for OLAP and slice and dice. And the uptake of this stuff on the business side is still negligible. And the result is that when these platforms get brought in, the management, noting that the general business populace can't grok it, start to hire analysts to work on those platforms to produce things on behalf of the business. Now, those analysts are necessarily limited by a platform that has to tame the data. And the moment we see it, by the time the data gets to the end point, it's been mushed up in and cut down and diced in so many ways that we can't see the provenance of the data. There's loads of sort of cuts and windows into the data that we can't, that are no use. We're being asked, part of the reason we're being asked something is because the bloody platform can't answer it, right? And so then you give me the platform and say, I can't answer this question, here's our data, and hand me a, you know, a link to a Power BI report. And I'm like, I can't do anything with this. Will it let me download the data? You know what I mean? And yeah. and it's, you know, they're trying to make this situation whereby you've got the data science and, you know, hardcore analyst edge on one side and the business users and the sort of business power users on the other side, and to sort of close that gap. And like data workbenches were sort of supposed to do that. But I personally believe that even with the advent of Gen AI, it's a twain that she'll never meet, because they're fundamentally different mindsets. They're not just different views in, they are fundamentally different mindsets. And to expect business users to think like we do, I think is unreasonable.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that, because that's really where this article starts to go. And I thought that's what the interesting point was. So, you know, he talks about these three jobs of the BI. And then, as you say, you know, the experience of these in the real world. And then he starts talking about, okay, well, how does AI help? And he talks about it really in the middle part, in the exploratory analysis, and effectively saying, well, why is it so useful here? Is because, as we're all discovering, one of the best use cases of LLMs at the moment is around code writing. And he talks about, there's a fairly new tool, a few months old, called Cursor, which I again, not really looked into, but I think is just an advanced coding IDE, you know, with a very good interface into an LLM. You know, and we know where this is going, which is, you know, if you've got the context of your code base and you ask a question, you know, it's far more likely to come up with code which is how you want it to be, and with a background in previous code you've written, and that's going to be nothing but helpful. And yeah, and then he talks about the people's experience with this kind of coding paradigm with the with AI, with the large language models, and allows you to write code quicker. And again, as you point out in this article, as we point out a lot of the time, when you're sort of doing this exploratory analysis, code is not the point. And so you want to create code, get an answer, don't like the answer, throw the code away. And what better tool to help you do this than one that does a whole load of code for you? You know, what might have taken you half an hour or a couple of hours is now done in a few minutes. You work with it over the next 20 minutes to hone it, get your answer, don't like it, move on. You know, you have even less less, what's the word I'm looking for? Less heart in that code. So, you know, throwing away is even easier. And so he talks about that paradigm. And then he talks about this new thing, which I hadn't heard of, called MCP, which is a new protocol, which he's saying called Model Context Protocol, which basically is a new protocol that sits between business tools, like a tool that might be helping you do some exploratory analysis, and the LLM, and allow you to go to any number of LLMs, from what I can tell. Again, I've just had a quick look. And, you know, it's a protocol layer which effectively is going to allow tools, as in things like Power BI or Tableau, to build to a common protocol, but then allow them to plug into other tools. And this really comes to the crux of his article, which really struck me. It was his basically saying, so you're now supercharging that person in the middle. They can use a bunch of tools with LLMs, get code coming out, getting it much quicker. We know also that LLMs are very good at converting outputs to different formats. So you can say, right, now I've got this. Take this data and whack it into, you know, a Power BI dashboard for me, you know, and it's going to be able to do that pretty quickly. And I think this MCP layer is about orchestrating that. And so he was talking about effectively, if that's the new, that's a new workflow, then the business intelligent tools are probably going to have to change. They're going to have to take on this layer. You know, if you're removing the exploratory data analysis because it's better done by people using a multitude of tools that actually you probably don't care about that much, because they can then just output it and get it into your tool, then you're going to shift to that sort of presentation and that protocol layer. And I just thought, for me, it was the first time really recently that anyone's proposed how, you know, we talk about AI changing the world, and this was actually a proposal of how it's going to do that. And what I quite liked about it was it wasn't like, oh, and so here's a new tool that does it for you, which is where most people are. Hey, look, we've got AI in our tool. This is the new world. What he's saying is probably the way people are going to start to work, which makes sense, using tools which can supercharge you. Why wouldn't you do that? So that is going to happen. And if you're a tool that has exploratory data analysis in it and you're not keeping up, and you won't keep up because this stuff's going to be coming out way too quick, then you are going to struggle unless you can find some other way in. And so that was really his point. It was really outlining that, look, the changes in productivity for these people in the middle, people like us, is going to change. I mean, the tools are going to have to change because the tools are never going to keep up. And so therefore, you're going to die unless you can offer some sort of interaction with that. And that is one of the first times I've heard, here's how I see AI changing a workflow, a bunch of tools. And again, like I say, not because he's saying, here's a new tool. He's saying, look, here's how people are working. You'd be nuts not to work this way. So tools are going to have to change to cope with that. Otherwise, they'll have no customers.
So are you saying, or is he saying, is it being said that because I can throw together any number of analyses and visualizations using LLMs in pretty quick time, I can not only do my job, I can usurp the job that the BI platforms are currently doing and make them obsolete while providing a service that's much richer.
And I think what he's saying is, therefore, as somebody running the platforms, you're going to really kind of panic on, right? Because if your tool, well, at least a third of it is based on this step of exploratory data analysis, and that's been taken away from you, your tool is left not with much to offer. And so, you know, I think he's saying that, you know, there's a big shakeup coming here, and he hasn't seen anything yet, but someone's bound to come in and fill that gap, because already there's this MCP protocol that's sprung up, you know, and that's it's just a protocol. It's just like HTTP, you know, it's not a tool. It's just a way for things to communicate. There's bound to be some others, and then there'll be a little war there. One will win out. And you know, it's a way for different sort of, I don't know, you almost call them fourth or fifth generation code generators to start talking to each other, you know. So what you're saying is you've got a tool which is enabling you to do analysis, and that tool can then plug into a tool which allows for distributed visualizations of production grade, and there you have that protocol in between, and that's great. That's exactly what you want. I want to be able to work in a tool which is better for my analysis, rather than being, as you said earlier, trying to work on a platform which isn't quite as good for analysis. But what's it good for? It's good for distribution.
Yeah.
So it struck me as, you know, really, well, kind of in our wheelhouse, but also eminently sensible.
I tend to agree. I'll sidestep the implicit increase in volatility that comes with that, right? I can easily see a situation where we go from death by spreadsheets to death by dashboard to death by random fucking, you know, interactive model things, right? In notebook type things. But in a well-managed environment, it certainly suits us and it should suit everyone. I don't know. I'll go and have a look at MCP. I've not heard of that. One thing I will note here was, well, there's a few things I've got to say. One, the BI arena is volatile for a reason, because it's a killer app. It's not very killer, right? Having worked in or around this industry for 20 plus years, I've yet to be convinced by the value of what ultimately boils down to dashboards, right? I'm still more of a proponent of Excel and people having those skills than you know, the supposed information distribution power of the BI platforms and the very, very paradigm of dashboards themselves, which are inherently backwards looking. In my mind, they fill one role, and that is what I would broadly term as contract fulfillment, i.e. you're my boss, we agreed that the sales for my division would go up 10% this year, we need a single version of the truth so we can agree that it's this 10% on that cell in that dashboard that needs to have gone up by this amount, and therefore you do need a window into your business to make sure you know what's going on. But it's sod all the uses of as an analytical tool. And it's barely any use as an operational tool. It's not something that people want to look at every day. And that BI, in my mind, should be proactive. The platform should be reactive to changes and anomalies and raise issues as they come about in an intelligent way. That means that people never have to check the dashboard, right? They shouldn't exist. And it's arguable that what you're saying here is a step towards that. But I've got a lot I can be said on the downsides and the issues with BI. The one thing I would note in the context of this new world is I was talking about Marimo last week, and continue to use it. Haven't got bored or moved back to Jupyter yet. But what that platform does is a big step towards what you're talking about, because not only are sort of widgets native, but you can switch your notebook to an app, a read-only app view at any time, right? Which can be run and will be refreshed automatically in a sane way, because it keeps track of the order of the cells, and you can then put the boring cells at the bottom and the fun cells at the top. And we get to this point where, you know, we have a notebook that has almost zero steps towards a distribution paradigm, providing you've got somewhere where you can serve it and your database can handle it, which is exactly the same problem you're going to have, you know, when going down the BI platform route. And I could go on for hours about why businesses often unplug BI platforms as a first port of call when money saving comes to the fore. But that's for another day.
Yeah. And just last word on it really was the sort of abstracting out. I thought it was quite interesting that the lesson here is, if you've got an existing process and paradigm which has some tooling, and that tooling doesn't really feel like it fulfills the process perfectly, but everyone's putting up with it, then AI stands a good chance of coming along and disrupting them, because people are already unhappy with how it works. And now something's coming along which allows maybe just one part of that process to be improved. Then you're just going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? And I just thought, hearing that, like I say, you know, just one of the first times that there's been a practical kind of use case laid out. You know, and he's not saying it's definitely going to go this way, but by seeing some of these things come together, he's going, well, okay, this is this is a fair chance. And this is a way it could happen. Now, it might happen differently, but at least, you know, and it happening in that way, which I think is different to what everyone's been saying, which is, you know, hey, look, AI in my tool will solve your problem. Whereas he's sort of not really saying that. He is saying that you'll have people like us using it as a tool in the background, enabling things, and then you'll get your insights quicker. At no point is the end business user used AI in that, not directly.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite key. You know, it's like somebody you know will be using it to improve the process, but you personally might not actually touch it.
Well, that's been going on forever, right? Facebook is jam-packed with AI, right? That no one even notices is there. It's a difference between explicit and implicit AI. And this is where I think Silicon Valley have got it wrong, in that they've been pushing Gen AI as an explicit tool when it isn't. It's by definition just a part of the process. It's an enrichment. It's a value add. It's a feature. But features don't make the hundreds of billions of dollars that they need to recoup their costs on all of this. We will almost certainly come back also to the subject of expertise as relates to Gen AI within the next, very, very shortly, because I'm going to start talking about it. But let's plow into where I am, because it does, to a degree, lead on from now. If I were a little detour. So I mentioned last week that I've been in a bit of an experimental trying new tools phase for various reasons. I went through my love affair with Marimo, which, as I say, is still on. Me and Marimo still dating.
Still blooming.
And also on the side, I've been having a cheeky affair with Polars and cheating on Pandas. Don't tell Pandas. Unfortunately, this is telling out to be a bit of a a bit of a ménage à trois. Oh dear. Let me explain my sordid technical love life to you. Pandas is my go-to girl, right? And has been for many years, and is probably the case for many or most data scientists. Pandas being, what a lot of even I think hardcore Pandas users don't even know is that the Pandas is a contraction or a portmanteau. It's a derivation of panel datas, which is effectively talking about really like spreadsheets and databases. Anyway, I digress. You know, it's an analytical tool. I use it to slice and dice data. It is what it is, right? What I found in this current project is I'm having to waft around some much bigger data. I'm talking about in the sort of 20 to 40 gig in memory in terms of amount, and I can cut it down. I can be more efficient. I can make all of this fit if I really wanted to, but I don't. I just can't be bothered. I'd rather just brute force it, right? Because it's a lot quicker, and this is a short contract. I need to work quickly. So my first port of call on finding out that Panda has kept on crashing my Python kernel or my Jupyter kernel was on my little 8 gig of RAM M1 MacBook, maybe I should try Polars because it's a bit more efficient and stuff. It's supposed to be faster, more efficient, and generally, you know, the modern, swanky, more hot equivalent. And so I thought, let's give Polars a view. And lo and behold, on the first sort of iterations of the data I was working in, it could handle it on my MacBook, right? So I thought, okay, I'll continue with this until, you know, a few iterations later when I crashed everything again. And was like, okay, well, I'm clearly exhausting my options here. And had a brief foray into Azure and Databricks, figured out that's really bloody expensive. and was like, well, before I go down this route, let's see what other options I had. Remembered my son has a Linux MacBook, that he, not MacBook, a Linux notepad. Notebook? No, what? What am I talking about? What's this Linux ThinkPad? Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, God, there's so many pads and books and notes and things. ThinkPad, Linux ThinkPad that he rarely uses because he's got a kick-ass gaming PC. And so I basically told him to lend it to me, as you do as a dad. And I jacked up the RAM in it to 64 gigs, and now I'm using it as a server, right? So brute forced that particular problem. And then Polars is now working marvelously. And to that point, I'd sort of converted everything I was doing into Polars and just decided to stick with it, even though I could probably still use Pandas if I wanted for this stuff. Anyway, so I'm now in a sordid, cheeky side affair with Polars, which is leaving me a bit, you know, I'm excited, but I'm a little bit nervous. There are some issues, not least just the bloody friction that comes from learning a new tool when it's so central to what you do. It's just, you know, I can imagine it's something similar moving from like Excel to Google Sheets or something. You know, it's all roughly the same, but you have to click on different things. You know, you have to find things in a different place, and suddenly something that you're doing would take you 2 minutes takes four, right? Not the end of the world, but when you've got 20 things like that, you know, it starts to be a real drag. And so that's not really an observation on Polars at all. It is just an observation on, you know, moving from one thing to other, learning new things. And as fun as it is, it, you know, it leaves me a little bit grumpy and stressed by the end of the day, simply because everything took a little bit more time and brain power. But I'm leaning into it. Me and Polars are getting to know each other. A few other things, I guess, is that it's syntactically a bit heavier than Polars, and it's I haven't done any character counts, but it feels a bit more character heavy. The sort of interface into the columns and stuff like that is not as neat and terse as Pandas, and I keep trying to do things that I'd be at doing Pandas, simple sort of column and row manipulations and stuff that you have to do a different way. And I seem a bit more obsessive about underscores in function names and stuff, and I have to second guess everything I'm doing because Pandas tends to have like compound names of functions and methods, whereas Polars tends to stick an underscore on it. And in fact, from Polars like 0.8 or 9, which was the last 0 version, to Polars 1, one of the big changes, given it's a breaking change release, was sticking bloody underscores everywhere. So I originally started on like 0.8. I have no idea why. It must have just been what was installed, because I have used Polars before. Wrote a bunch of code, upgraded, and everything broke. And it was almost exclusively because of bloody underscores. Anyway, these are all nitpicks. It's fast, it's efficient, it does what it says. It's got some things that I prefer to Pandas, and it's got some things that I don't. Yeah, I mean, it's not a huge difference, ultimately, and it just performs quite well. And much of what, I don't think I found anything in it, anything that's not in it that I would expect from Pandas.
Right.
And so will this become my go-to tool? I don't know, actually. It's really confusing because it is... For the sort of low, you know, the lower volume analysis that we're much more likely to do, there's just not that much in it. And I would argue that just the terseness of Pandas, if I don't need the performance gains of Polars, makes it probably still the go-to. If I've got to load a spreadsheet with a, you know, 500,000 rows, I'd probably stick with Pandas, I think. Because I just know it better and it's more familiar and there's less friction. One thing I will note, though, which is just so annoying, is that so I'm using GPT-4o on Merimo for inline code correction and stuff. And so you literally just do a keystroke and it brings up a box and you say, can you change this so it adds this column in, which is column A times column B or something, right? And almost every single time it gives me the pandas solution, right? Even if I say, can you take this polars, you know, in capitals data frame and do X with it, it gives me the pandas solution, or it gives me an out-of-date polars solution, right? That, given it's new, I understand both from Polar's perspective and OpenAI's perspective why it is the case, because, you know, 4.0 is a bit old now, right? And Polar's updated fairly recently. But the whole pandas polars thing, it just gets them confused, right? It just doesn't know which is which, because they are actually quite similar. And so that I've found extremely frustrating. But I will note that Googling for polars, I haven't struggled to find a solution, the Google Stack Overflow room.
Yeah.
Any questions so far, Klaas?
No, that reminds me of that last point very much about Pydantic, exactly the same thing, where they did an upgrade from, I think it was Pydantic 1 to 2, and it was a breakage release. And same thing, you ask the models, even now, some models haven't been updated since, you know, early last year. And I think that's when it went over to 2. And so their training data is mainly on Pydantic 1. And so, asking the models of Pydantic can be a bit of a coin toss. It gives you a whole load of stuff. And then you run it, it doesn't quite work. And then you get all these, like, you know, version 2 messages. And you look at it and you go, oh, great, you know. And of course, the model can't help you because it's never seen version 2.
Agreed. And there are various other things, not least bloody OpenAI API, which is out of date on GPT-4.2. I should come back to the ménage à trois, right? The reason I say this is because, you know, you could have polars in one notebook and pandas in another. What I'm finding is, at which point, you know, the two ladies don't meet each other and have a, you know, a fist fight. That actually what's happening is that once I've got the data sort of sliced and diced and pivoted and in a sort of more compact form, I'm looking at this going, well, I want to visualize this. Well, immediately I know exactly what I'm doing in the pandas matplotlib world. And there's also some transformations that I just know, muscle memory, right? So what I'm doing is doing the heavy lifting in polars, and then there's just a two pandas method. And I just cast it to a pandas and do my visualization that route, right? I'm not after anything swanky. I just want a distribution, histogram, something like that. You can do it all on polars. It's not hard. I'm a bit of a matplotlib old hand these days. So this is the ménage à trois, is that, I get the more energetic work done with polars and then switch to pandas for a little bit of more gentle, you know, visualization work. And there we have it. And Polar's just has to sit on the side looking bored and grumpy. Who knows? I really need to stop this analogy now, because I'm going to get myself into really, really quite tricky and sordid territory. Anyway, so my story sort of continues. I'm going to yadda, yadda, yadda it in Seinfeld style. I'm going to go yadda, 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 and then I started vibe coding, right? Which kind of relates back to what you were saying earlier. The short of the yadda is that I was just playing around with some stuff, and I wanted to, knowing now I can do some pretty funky stuff with polars, at volume conjured up a use case of trying to use embeddings or autoencoders to track customer behavioral paths to be able to cluster them, because sort of event paths are quite hard to cluster, because you might be looking for a little specific pattern that could be offset in time or a slightly different cadence, for example. Whereas, you know, people buying every 1 week and people buying every 2 weeks, in my mind, might as well be the same, right? Whereas people buying every 6 months is a different group, right? And so aligning all these cadences is really hard to do in simple vector form. And you can fuzzy them up with things like PCA or whatever. It still leaves you in a vector space that's slightly too sparse.
Right.
And so I was thinking, well, look, this is exactly what language models do, right? They take two sentences that mean the same thing and ultimately have them in the sort of the same probabilistic vector geography, right? And I was like, well, I can do the same thing in theory for this, and I've heard others do it. And so I was like, it's worth a try, but it's not a high priority. It just would be quite interesting to give it a go. So I didn't bother trying to figure out how to do it. I looked at things like dynamic time warping, by the way, and a few other things. There's some other approaches to this, but let's try this. But I was like, I'm not going to write all this shit, right? I just don't know how now, and I can't be bothered to go and find out. So I just went to Warp Terminal, typed in, and that's backed off by GPT-01, and said, just write me this thing that does this, right? That ultimately changes these, gets embeddings for these customer journeys. And it just went and did it, right? And it works, right? There's a whole bunch of stuff coming out of this. In my haste to do it, given it took me no effort, I hadn't really thought about how the hell I would know whether the clustering was working properly, right? Because I have no method to visualize in such a way that I can see that the clusters are working properly. I have no algorithmic method of saying that actually these two vectors are equivalent. Right. And I was sitting there going, it does something. Hooray. No idea if it does what I want. I sort of figured out some ways of getting a fairly easy, quick and dirty window in, and it is working. Whether it's working how I want, and devil's in the detail here. But it was quite a nice experiment. And sort of gives me some food for thought. It doesn't necessarily solve my problem, but I went and looked at the code that it made, and there's like a thousand lines of it or something, right? Last time I wrote an autoencoder, I swear I'd done it in like 50 lines or less. I mean, the autoencoder itself was like four lines of code in like PyTorch or something. I can't remember. Anyway, it just was like so much of it in there. And I'm like, I can't debug this, right? If I need to change this, I nicely put the parameters up top for me. Outside of that, I ain't got a clue, right? I mean, I'll figure it out, but it's going to take me hours if I have to change something, or I have to get it changed and it starts throwing errors or whatever, or even just to find out whether it's really doing what I think it's doing. And this brings me to vibe coding, because I hadn't realized this is a problem that we've been grumping about since LLMs became all the rage, but I didn't realize it had the name, and the name is vibe coding. I can't remember where I heard that the other day in some podcast. I was like, oh, there we go, we've got a name for it. I'd heard it around, but I didn't know what it meant, but someone actually told me, you know, somewhere, and I was like, oh yeah, this is the one, we know about this. So it's not like we weren't aware of it, it's just I didn't know it had that name. And that was me vibe coding, right? And and I'm a pretty good Python programmer. I can handle stuff like this, but it produced something that I'm like, I mean, look, as an experiment, it's fine. I don't care. So as things are right now, it doesn't matter to me that there's a billion lines of code in there. If it works, it works, right? But I'm quickly going to get unstuck if I try and follow this path, right? So as an experiment to say, can I in theory do this? It's marvelous, but I probably have to start again if I want to start doing it in anger, right? If I want to actually start working with the results and using it and get it production-wise or whatever. But and this is what terrifies me, and it really is a good example, because the reasoning models really do write some quite intense code, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they write all the tests for you and all this shit. This thing wrote tests. It wrote extra test scripts, test harness. There's like 5 Python files, right? And it was ridiculous, right? And well done for Warp Terminal for orchestrating all of that. But it's like, no, this is massive sledgehammer to crack a little baby peanut, right? And but other people are going to just stick this stuff in their notebooks or into production or something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. It's bonkers that this is going to happen. It's an apocalypse.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think it was either possibly a similar podcast, but somebody was talking about exactly that, you do your vibe coding, it comes out with something, and, we've always discussed this, how do you actually know it's doing what you want? And then you know there are going to be people there going, yeah, well, this seems to work. Look, there's 5 Python files here, including its own test harness. This must be good. Must work. Right, there you go, in production. And someone was talking about, well, and then you pick that up a couple of months later and you put another layer of LLM over it, some more vibe coding. Like you say, with these, the reasoning model, he would, before he goes into a meeting, so as a CEO, his day's meetings. And so before he goes into a meeting, he lays out the problem for this thing, knowing it's going to do exactly like you say, come up with a dozen Python files, 5,000 lines of code. Go to his meeting, come out, and then the code's all there and it can run through it and get it to do what he wants. But I think it was him that pointed out, that it's fine to knock something out like that. And you might take the bits you want. But yeah, I think it was him that pointed out that, like you say, well, let's just put this in production and move on. It's crazy. And what I've seen for tests written by LLMs, I wouldn't trust them. I mean, some of them were right, but...
My biggest issue, I think, here is that the models, rightly or wrongly, assume the sort of tightest use case, right? They sort of assume that what's written in that one sentence is the entirety of what you want, right? And therefore, they'll build it in a completely non-extensible way. For example, I didn't bother saying, can you make... Because I said, right, as a script, I didn't bother saying, can you make the parameters available on the command line? So, no, it didn't. It just hard-coded them in a dictionary. Stuck them at the top. I mean, it did it sensibly. But, I mean, honestly, if I'm writing a script, why do I don't want hard-coded values. I don't ever want that. Again, stick it in your system prompts and stuff. You can tie this stuff up. But it's all these little things. And then I asked it, I says, like, well, it's run it. It created the vectors for me because I had a file of strings that it needed to vectorize. And it did it, right? It did it, tests it, then did it for all the strings. And it's marvelous. And I was like, yeah, but I only put like 1,000 in there. I've got like 4 million, right? So I was like, well, how do I rerun it? And I just couldn't be bothered to even look at the script when I noticed it was 1,000 lines. So I said, ask the model, how do I retrain it? And it wrote a new script, right? I was like, okay. So I looked at the new script, saw what it was doing. Okay, that does what it does. So I used it and retrained it. I was like, but why? I went back and looked in the script, and all I needed to do was just rerun the original one, right? It's just like the original one is set up to do that. Literally just run it again and it'll overwrite everything, right? Again, is that what I want? Well, in this case, it's fine. But like, it wrote a new script, right? It basically duplicated it. And I was like, well, what? Why would you do that? Because I wasn't very explicit. The answer I was expecting is for it to say, I'll just run it again or run it again with these flags or whatever. Nope, didn't do that. And that's bonkers. Because if you aren't questioning it or you didn't really understand this stuff, you can end up with way more code, like lots and lots and lots of code where you probably don't need it, where it's coded for edge cases that you didn't ask for, created a bunch of stuff that you don't need, abstracted in a way that isn't conducive to maintenance, put that in to production, and then, okay, it all works fine. What happens when someone has to, upgrade it, write new features, debug it? You've got 10 billion lines more code than you needed. You know what I mean?
It's the age-old problem of getting used to working with them. Are they really doing what you want? And what is still somewhat of an art rather than a science is knowing when to cut your losses. And I had a similar example the other day. I was looking at some, I always call it T-Kinter in my head. I presume that's the way that they talk about it. The Python GUI library.
Yeah.
And, I don't use that a lot. And so I'm not massively familiar with it. And I was just doing this little side thing. It produced some code and I was just checking it over. And it was just trying to recreate a time series graph. And it was pretty rubbish. And basically the idea was to show how rubbish it is against, matplotlib or seaborn. Saying that, it should still be able to produce a graph with axes with ticks on it. And it done all this code, and yet when you displayed it, there were no ticks and no numbers on the axis. And I'm looking at this code, I'm not familiar with T-Kinter, so I'm just like, well, look, you seem to have put a title in. And I asked it three or four times, kept going back, I still can't see the numbers, can't see the ticks, and it kept redoing it, like I say, rewriting the code, adding bits in, still nothing coming up on the screen. So I just stared at it for about 10 minutes and I did that, good thing you always do. You think, right, well, it's trying to put the ticks in at these specific points. Let's just put them in randomly on the screen and see what happens. And then I noticed on one of the axes, it sort of had, you could just see these little gaps. And I'm like, so maybe, it was like it'd give me a default white screen. So maybe the text is white. And it's writing the white text on a white background. That's why I can't see it. So, and look up. Oh, there's already code that's given me the title that says filler equals black. Not how I would do it, but hey, it is what it is. So I copy that over. Filler equals, all the ticks suddenly appear.
Yeah.
So basically, it gave me code to put text in for a title with the color in it, but I hadn't done it for any of the labels for the axis. And continuously, didn't do that. Said, it's not working. I can't see it. And then you're looking at it and you go, right. And that's one of the classics. So why am I using it? Well, because I don't really know much about T-Kinter. I can go and look it up. This is only going to be a short piece of work, blah, blah, blah. Now it's not working. Shit, now I've got to debug it and I don't really have the expertise. Although it seemed like not having the expertise was actually the answer to the problem. But, as we always say, well, at what point do you cut your losses there and say, why am I, let's just go and find an alternative?
Well, the answer is after it's taking longer to get to that point, it would have done just to do it yourself, right? Which is always the case. I think it's TK Inter, because I think it's based on TK, which is a graphics library and Inter for interface is my guess, but there you go.
I might
be wrong. Yeah. It could be T-Kinter, T-Kinter. Right.
Into, yeah.
Right.
Well, it always gets employed as TK, so that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I predict a vibe coding apocalypse, and now I have the terminology for it. I'm sticking with it. And we've been saying this for 2 years now, that there's going to be a point where people like us who actually know what they're doing are going to be like the heroes of everything, when we're brought in at ridiculous day rates to fix all the problems that vibe coders have created and probably un-engineer a whole bunch of stuff out. It's going to be the Y2K problem part two, right? I think this is going to be an absolute shit show, right? And I'm not just saying that as a grumpy old school dev who feels like my lawn is being trampled on by a bunch of Johnny-come-latelys. I'm saying this because I keep almost falling into the trap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just can't work like this. And if these people are doing their coding via LLMs, they're not learning how to do it properly. So not only that, the next generation developers are not going to be very good at this. So we'll be absolutely reliant on old school, you know, older or more experienced, I should say, developers, and the ability of the language models to fix their own crap, which they've yet to demonstrate, right, as you point out. So,
well, that sounds to me like the way forward is a specialized model which fixes code. So that sounds like there's a whole new industry being born.
Yeah, let's
right
do
now.
It. Large code models. Right. So we are absolutely going to come back to this problem, this particular coming doom prophecy. But we should probably stop because we've been talking for a long time.
Well, we should speak next week.
Yep. See ya. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Confusion matrix.